conspiracies, endless wars, hidden forbidden history, the depopulation agenda, cryptozoology, mystical visions, hidden mysteries, advanced subterranean civilizations, flying saucers, alien abductions, and secret space programs, time travel, wellness, and healthy living. Where do you go to find out about these subjects and more? To James Bartley's Cosmic Switchboard Show. That's where. James Bartley will provide cutting-edge information and will interview the top investigators and researchers in a variety of fields. Listen in every week to the Cosmic Switchboard Show, hosted by James Bartley.
Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you are listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, we will be initiating a new feature of the Cosmic Switchboard Show, which I refer to as Bartley's Commentaries on the Cosmic Wars. Every Wednesday, either myself and or some guests will be discussing various aspects of what we refer to as the Cosmic Wars, which have extended out, unfortunately, to our solar system. And these cosmic wars manifest in a variety of forms. We see them as chemtrails, the all-out assault on the human immune system, the GMO issue, the endless wars, the rumors of wars, basically everything that one has perceived as being a matrix-type issue, we will discuss, and we will discuss it at a number of different levels. So today, what I would like to do is talk about the necessity for people to up their game, for lack of a better term. Too many people look at the problems in the world through the filter of the 5 cents conspiracy. They only see power mad bankers. They only see the problems with corporations. They only see the corruption in politics, and they can't see beyond that. They don't realize that there is an essentially non-human intelligence behind all these problems, and that what is going on here on Earth and throughout our solar system is merely an extension of cosmic multidimensional wars going back countless millennia, indeed millions and millions of years, eons in fact. So I believe it is important that those people that are straddling the fence, they're going by their inner guidance, their intuition that tells them there's something more to this conspiracy than what the five senses perceive. David Icke's most recent lecture tour, he goes into detail from the very beginning. It takes a long time. It's about an 11-hour lecture, but he breaks it down from beginning to end. Takes you to the surface level, why we have had our perceptions manipulated and for what purpose, and why we have developed or our controllers have developed a phantom self for us, and why this phantom self has been plugged into a phantom world, a matrix reality. And then he'll take you through the whole process. The last two or three parts of the lecture, he delves into the cult of Saturn. He delves into the true nature of reality, the archons, the reptilians. He talks about artificial intelligence. And those are key aspects of this whole matrix control system, which must be understood. Because too many people butt the top of their head into the ceiling that they have allowed to be created above themselves by a dogmatic belief in bogus science. And I always thought that it was amusing that a lot of the 9/11 truthers, for example, look at the results of the NIST findings, for example, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, and they say, okay, the official story they're giving us is ridiculous. It defies the known observed facts. And in fact, it defies science. And likewise, when the medical tyrannical psychopaths push these patently dangerous medical treatments in the guise of medical treatments, i.e. chemotherapy, radiation treatments, vaccines, And people point to the cause and effect, and they say, okay, this, again, is an example of standing science on its head. We see the malign effects of these treatments. The medical experts, so-called, insist on inverting truth and standing reality on its head and saying it's good for us. And they say, we're the whack jobs. And they have all these bought and paid for scientists and doctors with their bought and paid for medical journals. And then they create this whole stream of utter drivel and nonsense. And people that are standing up to the medical tyranny say, okay, that's all nonsense, because it defies reason, it defies basic common sense, and it stands science on its head. Yet many of those same people buy into the dogma spewed out by the academic community that holds that this is just a five-sense world, there are no other dimensions, aliens don't exist, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they know that the science that's invoked by the control system is largely bogus, and yet they buy into the bogus science when it comes to subjects such as aliens, UFOs, so on and so forth, interdimensional vortex activity, interdimensional beings, subterranean beings, subterranean civilizations, ancient advanced civilizations. For us to get to where we need to go, we need to see beyond the five-sense conspiracy. We will be heading into a whole nother level of strangeness, as Alex Collier points out. Now stop and think about it. We're already being harped unmercifully, the HARP project. Scalar waves, which can be used for good purposes, are being used for, at times, malign purposes. We have fracking. Fracking is to the earth and to the water systems and the subterranean water systems, river systems, aquifers, etc. Fracking is to the earth what chemspraying is to the sky. It's destroying the planet. And I can go on and on and on about how the world is being destroyed at many different levels, to the point that it's affecting what lamestream physicists refer to as the fabric of reality. One cannot constantly beam out at very high levels, high frequencies, set off all kinds of nuclear weapons, and do all this damage to the earth, sky, and the very frequency of the earth that we are residing in without some sort of knock-on effect. There will be manifold repercussions all across the board, and all living things are sensitive to frequencies and vibrations and energies. So we're constantly being bathed in a smog of electromagnetic pollution. Again, as many people have pointed out, that's affecting our genetic structure, it's affecting our DNA, it's affecting our cellular structure, not just for us, but for all life forms on the planet. So we have to up our game. And what I would like to do now is talk about the basics of the UFO alien military aerospace connection to help people get to that next level, the ones that are straddling the fence. I'm going to be preaching to the choir for many of the listeners that already know this. They already know that non-human intelligences are in control of the matrix system, but there are people still straddling the fence that know that there's something more beyond the five-sense conspiracy. For this part of my talk today, I am talking to them in particular. I want to get them to the next level. One of my favorite things to talk about in the UFO ET field is the Robert Sarbacher memo. And it's important to understand that there is a body of evidence, a huge, voluminous literature on the subject, which proves to the satisfaction of many that at very high levels of government, military, corporate interest, the latter take alien life forms and alien technology for granted. And one of the best forms of evidence that I found is the Dr. Robert Sarbacher memo. Dr. Robert Sarbacher was a consultant for the Pentagon in the 1950s. He had his own missile development company. And much later down the track in the 1980s, he was the Institute for the Washington He was the dean of the Washington Institute of Technology, tracking down scientists, academics, military personnel who were involved with the secret back engineering alien technology program is very much like the spy versus spy game. If you find one spy, very often it will lead you to another spy. And so that was the case with Dr. Robert Saarbrücker. So let me backtrack and talk about how we came to have the Dr. Robert Saarbrücker memo. There was a Canadian engineer named Dr. Wilbert Smith, who worked with the Department of Transportation for the Canadian government. He eventually headed up a Canadian secret UFO project called Project Second Story. In Dr. Wilbert Smith's capacity as an official for the Canadian government, in the early 1950s, he was in Washington, D.C., and he spoke to an unnamed, unspecified member of the U.S. Defense Department establishment. As a result of this discussion, Wilbert Smith wrote to his superiors in the Canadian government that, one, flying saucers exist. Two, the matter is the most highly classified in the United States government at that time, rating 2 points higher even than the hydrogen bomb, which at that time was being developed by the United States government. The third point made in this memo that Dr. Wilbert Smith submitted to his superiors in the Canadian government was, there is a small group headed up by Dr. Vannevar Bush that is actively striving to learn the secrets of the UFO technology, aliens, et cetera, et cetera. Now, when Wilbert Smith died, there was a researcher named William Steinman, a very dogged, determined researcher, who went to the widow of Dr. Wilbert Smith and asked if he can gain access to Wilbert Smith's private papers. Dr. Wilbert Smith's widow had nothing to hide. She says, sure, go ahead and check out his papers. So if I remember the story correctly, William Steinman went up to the attic of the widow of Dr. Wilbert Smith's house and started sorting through all his papers, and he found the aforementioned document that was mentioned by, that was written by Dr. Wilbert Smith to his superiors, mentioning those 3 points I made, that the flying saucers exist. It's the highest classified program subject in the United States government at that time, and that a small group headed up by Dr. Vannevar Bush was actively seeking out the secrets to aliens and alien technology, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what William Steinman then did, like all good investigators do, and this is, you know, relates to the spy versus spy, you find one spy, it leads you to another spy aspect I referred to earlier. Dr. William Steinman did the follow-up research, and he determined that the unnamed defense consultant that Wilbert Smith had the private meeting with around 1950 was none other than Dr. Robert Saarbrücker. So William Steinman contacted Dr. Robert Saarbrücker and wrote him a series of letters asking him to confirm the meeting that he had had with Dr. Wilbert Smith. And eventually, he did receive a letter from Robert Saarbrücker. And that letter is astounding as far as implications are concerned. And I will read to you at length what Dr. Robert Saarbrücker wrote to William Steinman. This was written on the letterhead of the Washington Institute of Technology, November 29th, 1983. And he addressed it to Mr. William Steinman of Rosalita Drive, La Mirada, California. Dear Mr. Steinman, I am sorry I have taken so long in answering your letters. However, I have moved my office and have had to make a number of extended trips. To answer your last question in your letter of October 14, 1983, there is no particular reason I feel I shouldn't or couldn't answer any or all of your questions. I am delighted to answer all of them to the best of my ability. You listed some of your questions in your letter of September 12th. I will attempt to answer them as you had listed them. One, relating to my own experience regarding recovered flying saucers, I had no association with any of the people involved in the recovery and have no knowledge regarding the dates of the recoveries. If I had, I would send it to you. Point two, regarding verification that persons you list were involved, I can only say this. John von Neumann was definitely involved. Dr. Vannevar Bush was definitely involved, and I think Dr. Robert Oppenheimer also. My association with the Research and Development Board under Dr. Compton during the Eisenhower administration was rather limited, so that although I had been invited to participate in several discussions associated with the reported recoveries, I could not personally attend the meetings. I am sure they would have asked Dr. von Braun, and the others that you listed were probably asked and may or may not have attended. That is all I know for sure. He went on to state that he did have access to reports about the recovered alien technology and the efforts at back engineering said alien technology when Robert Sarbacher was in his office in the Pentagon. Again, he was a Pentagon consultant. He referred to himself as a dollar a year man. Essentially, he was an unpaid consultant for the Pentagon. He went on to say that, according to the reports that he had read, that he had been cleared to read, that the material found at some of these crash sites was very light, but very strong, very durable, very resistant. And again, this echoes the testimony of many of the people involved in various aspects of the Roswell crash retrieval, that the people, including the late Lieutenant Colonel Jesse Marcel, the 509th Bomb Wing intelligence officer who made it out to the crash site at Roswell, he and many others talked about this foil-like substance that was had memory aspects to it. It could be crumpled up, and then when you open up your hand, the material would flatten itself out. And despite being pliable and having memory, it was extremely durable and tough. And they couldn't cut it. They couldn't burn it. They couldn't even shoot an artillery shell through the thin foil. And here is Dr. Robert Sarbacher talking about that very same material, that it is very light and yet very strong and very durable. William Steinman had asked Dr. Robert Sarbacher about the Aztec crash retrieval in particular. Now, to this day, there are many so-called serious UFO researchers that dismiss the Aztec recovery of March 1948 as being a hoax and never having happened, but I am satisfied that it did. And the spy versus spy, you find one spy, which leads you to another spy aspect, comes to the fore in this case. The scientists that I mentioned earlier were legends in the field at the time and to this day. Now, note who Dr. Sarbacher mentioned. Dr. John von Neumann was definitely involved in the analysis of the recovered alien technology, and Roswell and Aztec were just the tip of the iceberg. There was the crash retrieval, and some would argue that it was actually a planned landing by a certain ET group in Kingman, Arizona, my old stomping grounds, in 1953. There was the crash retrieval on December 9th, 1965, in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania. Some people say that it was some kind of Nazi craft. I don't believe that. There were stories that came out much afterwards about Kecksburg that when the Army personnel went into the woods, they heard a loud, unearthly scream that the whole town of Kecksburg basically was taken over by the military. And there were many other crash retrievals. One of my future guests, Richard Smith, an outstanding UFO investigator in his own right, will be talking about the Long Island UFO crashes of the late 1980s, early 1990s, which resulted in Long Island UFO investigator John Ford becoming a political prisoner because of his dogged efforts at finding out details about the crash retrievals of alien craft in Long Island in the late 80s, 1990s. Okay, so we track back to Dr. Robert Sarbacher. Robert Sarbacher admitted in his letter that the Aztec crash of 1948 was real. And he mentioned a number of scientists by name. Now, let's talk about the credentials of some of these scientists, because the prevailing view of the media and quackademia is that anyone who believes in flying saucers and aliens is by definition a crackpot, wears a tinfoil hat, yada, yada, yada. Okay. Dr. John von Neumann was identified by Dr. Robert Saarbrücker as being definitely involved. Who was Dr. John von Neumann? A mathematician, a computer scientist, Institute of Advanced Study in Princeton. And one of the first computer scientists, in fact, he interacted at some level with what many regard as the father of modern computing, Alan Turing. Alan Turing was involved in the decryption of the Enigma cipher, and particularly the naval cipher of the German U-boats in World War II. Dr. John von Neumann was a consultant to the Manhattan Project, and he played a key role in developing, doing the math work and the, studying the physics behind explosives, which resulted in a number of innovations in World War II regarding anti-tank shells, so on and so forth. Dr. John von Neumann, one of the legends of modern science, a Hungarian. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine, Helga Moro, she was the daughter of a German expatriate scientist and engineer named Dr. Frederick Augustus Kepars. And Dr. Frederick Augustus Kepars went to the United States in the 1930s and obtained a job with one of the aircraft companies at the time. At the time, there was only several aircraft companies, and later there was a lot of merging of said aircraft companies, and then those merged aircraft companies became the aerospace giants of today. And if memory serves, Dr. Frederick Augustus Kepars joined Glenn L. Martin Aircraft Company, which later became Martin Marietta, which later merged with Lockheed Martin and became Lockheed Martin. And Helga, as a young girl, remembers Dr. John von Neumann coming to her house, talking to her father, Dr. Frederick Augustus Kepars. And later, when Helga Moro was older, she recalls Dr. Frederick Augustus Kepars, her father, talking about alien technology, talking about how all history was a lie, and that he basically, her father had a nervous breakdown because one of his jobs was teaching human-looking aliens to assimilate themselves into human society. And the same Dr. Frederick Augustus Kepars worked closely with Dr. John von Neumann, who was identified by Dr. Robert Saarbrücker as being involved in the project. Now, who were some of these other individuals? Dr. Vannevar Bush was identified by Dr. Robert Saarbrücker. Who was Dr. Vannevar Bush? Dr. Vannevar Bush was an MIT engineer. And prior to and during World War II, he formed some key research and development organizations, the National Defense Research Committee, and then later the Office of Scientific Research and Development, an offshoot of which became the Manhattan Project. S1, actually, was the name of the sub-project of Office of Scientific Research and Development, headed up by Dr. Vannevar Bush. Dr. Vannevar Bush was an ideal individual to head up the secret back engineering alien technology projects because of his experience during World War II as head of the Office of Scientific Research and Development, OSRD. The OSRD oversaw a number of projects during World War II involving radar, the proximity fuse, i.e. when anti-aircraft shell is fired at an aircraft, a small, tiny radar inside the shell will actually tell the shell that it is within close proximity of an aircraft and detonate. So the proximity fuses did not require a shell to hit an aircraft. It would just explode the shell in close proximity to an aircraft where the blast effect and the shrapnel would do damage to the aircraft. The proximity fuse, Office of Scientific Research and Development. One of the people, the key people involved in the Office of Scientific Research and Development program to develop the proximity fuse was a guy who became a key player of the Manhattan Project, Captain later, a Naval Admiral Deke Parsons, who had later headed up the Armed Forces Weapons Project at Sandia Base. So Dr. Robert Sarbacher identified Dr. Vannevar Bush as being involved in the secret UFO project. He also mentioned Dr. Julius Robert Oppenheimer. Dr. Robert Oppenheimer was a Caltech physicist, theoretical physicist, and also a theoretical physicist at Berkeley. He was trained in Göttingen, one of the early theoretical physicists, especially American theoretical physicists. In the early days of the Manhattan Project at Berkeley, he was involved in fast neutron research. He became the director of the Los Alamos Project to develop nuclear weapons, the uranium device known as Little Boy, and the plutonium device, implosion device, known as Fat Man. After World War II, Dr. Robert Sarbacher became the chairman of the General Advisory Committee of the Atomic Energy Commission, the forerunner of today's Department of Energy. The chairman of the General Advisory Committee of the Atomic Energy Commission was a very powerful position. Oppenheimer sat on a number of advisory boards for the U.S. government and defense establishment. He became a member of the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton, identified by Dr. Robert Sarbacher as being involved in the back engineering of alien technology, and identified by a number of eyewitnesses as being directly involved in the crash retrieval of the craft in Aztec, New Mexico in 1948. According to some leaked documents, he was also called to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Dr. Robert Oppenheimer was called to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base to study what appeared to be some kind of a nuclear reactor that was found within a recovered alien craft. Again, spy versus spy. You find one spy, interrogate that spy, debrief that spy, and oftentimes that spy will lead you to other spies. Same situation we have with the secret saucer scientist. You find one, oftentimes they'll lead you to another secret saucer scientist. Who else did Dr. Robert Sarbacher identify in the Sarbacher memo? He identified Dr. Carl Compton. Dr. Carl Compton, at the time of the UFO crash retrievals in the 40s, late 40s and early 1950s, was the director of the Joint Army-Navy Research and Development Board, which after a number of name changes became the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Dr. Carl Compton was the head of the Joint Army-Navy Research Development Board. And through that agency worked Dr. John von Neumann, Oppenheimer, Vannevar Bush, and they were definitely involved in the recovery analysis of alien technology. Dr. Carl Compton's brother, Arthur Compton, won the Nobel Prize for his research in cosmic rays. So again, these are the giants of science. Von Neumann, Dr. Carl Compton, Oppenheimer. And what is interesting is today we hear over and over, oh, DARPA, they developed blue beam technology to fool people into thinking aliens are real. That's like putting the cart before the horse. The predecessor of DARPA, the originator of DARPA, the Joint Army Navy Research and Development Board, was working with alien technology. And then decades later down the track, people who don't know that history are blowing smoke about how DARPA created all this blue beam technology to fool people into thinking that aliens are real. Again, that's like putting the cart before the horse. What came first, the chicken or the egg? Again, people have to up their game. I know the subject of aliens and alien technology is scary. Because if even one person out there is getting abducted by aliens, then that puts us on very shaky ground. Then we have to consider all these other stories from countless witnesses about huge underground civilizations, about huge underground bases populated by aliens, reptilian bases that are processing plants. I'll get to that later. So a lot of people dismiss this out of hand because of the brainwashing they've been subjected to. And why do people dismiss the subject of UFOs at hand? I just mentioned some of the top researchers and scientists in history: von Neumann, Oppenheimer, Vannevar Bush. These people weren't crackpots. These people didn't walk around wearing tinfoil hats. I'll tell you why, because in 1953, the CIA instituted a comprehensive program of debunking UFO sightings and alien contact of any sort by paid quackademics on the one hand, and using the controlled media to ridicule witnesses on the other hand. So on the one hand, these paid quackademics, people who, with letters after their name, who call themselves doctors, scientists, they make these dismissive comments about aliens and UFOs and say it's all ridiculous, it's all nonsense, and only crazy people believe in it. And then they come up with all these flaccid explanations to explain away UFO sightings on the one hand. And on the other hand, the media ridicules witnesses who have the guts and the self-worth to come forward. And that program has taken on a life of its own. Here we are, 2016, and the lamestream media and quackademic community still has a dismissive tone about the subject of aliens and alien life forms and UFOs. The ridicule curtain comes down in the media every time the subject is brought up. Well, not every time. Once in a while, they'll roll out a military expert who will try to frighten the audience into thinking that aliens are going to invade. Little blip on the radar, then they go away. But when a civilian pops up or a civilian investigator, oh, they just laugh at them on TV. And a lot of you truthers out there fall for that because it feels good to laugh at others, doesn't it? It's like the mentally retarded kids, excuse me, in grade school or in high school, or the people with cerebral palsy, or people who just look different, or misfits, or people who dress funny. We like to point at them and laugh because it makes us feel good, doesn't it? It elevates us. And a lot of surface level truthers have this attitude. Oh, I'm awakened. I'm a truther. Oh, these people that think Al-Qaeda did 9/11. I look down upon them. I look down my nose at them because it makes me feel good, doesn't it? Because we do like to look down at people. Let's admit it. Let's face it. At times, we like to feel superior to others. Therein lay the strength of the debunking and ridiculing propaganda psyop against the public, the American public mostly, and the English public, and the Australian public, and the European public. But in other countries, aliens and alien life forms are taken for granted. Latin America, Asia, Africa. It's only in the developed countries, in the civilized countries, so-called, where this ridicule curtain comes down, this laughter curtain comes down. Now, those are just civilian scientists I mentioned. The list of military personnel who've been deeply involved in the recovery and analysis of alien technology is through the roof as far as the names are concerned. I'm a student of military history with an emphasis on World War II. General Nathan Twining, deeply involved in the recovery and analysis of alien technology. General Nathan Twining at the time of Roswell was the commander of the Air Materiel Command at Wright Field, later Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. He was in New Mexico a few days after the crash retrieval. He was known to be there. Twining became chief of staff of the Air Force and became the first Air Force general to become chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He wrote the Twining memo, which basically stated that flying saucers are real. There's something real, not fictitious or visionary. He also was involved with other generals who were deeply involved with alien technology. In fact, the Air Force Chief of Staff that he replaced, General Hoyt Vandenberg, General Hoyt Vandenberg's uncle was Arthur Vandenberg, a very powerful Republican senator. Hoyt Vandenberg was the commander of the 9th Air Force in World War II. He was also the head of the Central Intelligence Group after World War II, a predecessor of the CIA. Hoyt Vandenberg was known to be deeply involved in the recovery and analysis of alien technology. As chief of staff of the Air Force, he ordered an estimate of the situation written up by the Air Technical Intelligence Center, based at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Air Technical Intelligence Center wrote an estimate of the situation in 1948, in which they concluded that UFOs were interplanetary. General Hoyt Vandenberg said to the people who wrote this memo, "Are you trying to cause a stampede?" And he ordered the estimate of the situation to be burned and no copies to be made. Now, Vandenberg knew the truth by then. Of course he did. Admiral Roscoe Hillenconner was the director of the Joint Intelligence Center of the Pacific, JIXIPAC, as we used to say in naval communications. He wound up becoming a director of the CIA. Admiral Roscoe Hillenconner stated for the record that at the highest levels of the Air Force, flying saucers are taken very seriously, I'm paraphrasing here, and that the Air Force will censor their own pilots who make reports. There are no shortage of high-level, world-famous military generals and admirals who've been very straightforward about the reality of alien life forms and alien technology. General Curtis LeMay was the commander of the 20th Air Force. It was under the 20th Air Force that the bombing, the nuclear bombing of Japan took place. The 509th Composite Bomb Wing was a component of the 20th Air Force based in Guam. After World War II, General Curtis LeMay became head of the Air Force Research and Development Division, and still later he became the commanding general of Strategic Air Command. In his memoirs, which were ghostwritten, he said flying saucers are real. UFOs are real. In a well-known story, Barry Goldwater, a very powerful Arizona senator who wrote a book called With No Apologies, if memory serves, that was a correct title, where he openly called out the Council on Foreign Relations and a Trilateral Commission. Barry Goldwater ran for U.S. president, and the mainstream media always ganged up on him and said, if you elect this guy as president, he's going to start World War III and a nuclear annihilation for all life forms on Earth. That was the meme that the mainstream media used against Barry Goldwater. Barry Goldwater was also a reserve Air Force general with a top secret clearance. Barry Goldwater was the chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, a very powerful position. Barry Goldwater tried to gain unauthorized access into the Foreign Technology Division at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and tried to gain access to the so-called Blue Room, where, depending on your source, alien artifacts are kept there, and according to some sources, alien bodies are kept in the Blue Room. Now, alien bodies are known to have been kept at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for many years. According to the late, great Leonard Stringfield, as far back as 1966, according to his sources, Stringfield says that there were at least 30 different alien bodies at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base by the time 1966 rolled around. So Barry Goldwater, in his capacity as an Air Force Reserve General with a top secret security clearance, and as chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, a very powerful oversight committee, tries to gain access into Wright-Patterson Air Force Base's Alien Technology Division. He runs smack dab into the aforementioned General Curtis LeMay. General Curtis LeMay rips Goldwater up one side and down the other and tells him, don't ever ask again, okay? And I haven't even gotten into all the Air Force and naval aviators and Marine pilots and pilots around the world, military pilots who've been scrambled after flying saucers and alien craft in general and have been debriefed, made to sign non-disclosure statements, been harassed, been threatened with all kinds of punishment if they spoke out. And I've spoken to some of these military pilots. Likewise, a number of these military pilots have disappeared entirely or have crashed as a result of these fruitless, in many cases, UFO jet chases. The Captain Thomas Mantell case in 1948, very famous case in the UFO lore. Thomas Mantell was vectored onto a gigantic metallic craft, and he was flying his plane up towards it, and then Basically, they lost radio contact with him and he crashed. And there were many others that this happened to. So the point I'm making is this is very serious. Now, 1940s, 1950s, and if one wants to argue the case, according to Jim Mars, and he's done a lot of research on the subject, the U.S. government has had a crash-recovered alien craft since at least, if memory serves, 1898, when one of the so-called airships crashed near modern-day Dallas-Fort Worth. The UFO researchers listening will recall that in the late 1890s, the whole of America was besieged by so-called airship sightings. These looked like, in some cases, large dirigibles that floated along very slowly, and in some cases were seen, I'm not making light of this, to be hoisting cattle up into the belly of their craft. And one moment, these large dirigibles would be floating along very slowly. The next, they would fly away at high speed, described by some witnesses as a bullet being shot out of a rifle. What Bill Hamilton calls zero point acceleration. You go from just a standing start to zip, no acceleration, full speed. Dr. Herman Oberth, who was what some regard as a paperclip scientist, he mentored Dr. Wernher von Braun. And after World War II, he secured himself a position working as a consultant with the U.S. Army Missile Development Program in Huntsville, Alabama. And Dr. Herman Oberth stated for the record, and again I'm paraphrasing, that the reason why flying saucers don't emit sonic booms and don't make a lot of sound when they fly, or in some cases don't make a lot of sound, and the reason why they're able to make instantaneous right-hand turns, instantaneous changes of direction, is because they generate their own gravitational field. So this is Herman Oberth talking about alien propulsion, electrogravitics, field propulsion. So it takes us back to the very purpose why I decided to have this discussion, this particular commentary, because I've been talking about alien technology and alien back engineering efforts that go back at least to the 1940s. Now, fast forward, we're in 2016. The powers that be, and a lot of these corporations, what start out as a handful of aircraft companies, which later morphed into the aerospace giants we know today, they have their hands on this technology. And let us never forget what the late Ben Rich said. Ben Rich was the former director of Lockheed Skunk Works. And when it amounted to a deathbed confession, he told Tom Keller, I think his name is, or Kelleher, who is an aerospace consultant with the Mutual UFO Network. And when it amounted to a deathbed confession, Ben Rich stated that we have the technology now, based on alien technology, to enable the military to travel the stars, that it won't take years to get there, that there was a problem with the equations. I would argue that these are Einstein's equations, and that they corrected these equations, and now the military routinely travel the stars. He went on to say that the navigation is based on ESP, the old term people used for describe psi abilities, psychic abilities, extrasensory perception, that the occupants of these craft seem to have a psychic telepathic link with the technology, and they do, which enables them to make these split-second decisions that allow the craft to conduct these extraordinary, by our standards, surface-level standards, maneuvers. Ben Rich went on to say that they have a small fleet of craft that are based on alien technology and alien propulsion systems. I would argue that we have large fleets by now of alien technology-based craft, what some have referred to as alien replicated vehicles. I've seen many themselves, although I wouldn't go so far as to say as many do today. It's a very common meme. All sightings of craft, especially triangular-shaped craft, are of necessity military craft developed by the aerospace corporations. I think that's nonsense. I think some of them are, even many of them are, but not all of them. I've stood beneath some of the man-made triangular-shaped craft. They, at least the ones that I've seen, emit an electrostatic kind of noise, can hover for a long period of time. A lot of times they'll have a large red glowing part beneath the craft in the center, and on each corner they'll have a lighted circle. But that also replicates what some actual alien craft look like. Some actual alien craft look like that. So what came first, the chicken or the egg? Okay, we're back to that argument. So, and it must be understood that the progenitor of the all UFOs and all alien craft are the setting of stealth craft, that originated with Admiral Bobby Ray Inman. Bobby Ray Inman was a former director of Naval Intelligence, and he was also a former director of the National Security Agency, a director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and a deputy director of the CIA. He later wound up on the board of directors for Science Applications International Corporation, SAIC, based in San Diego. In other words, Bobby Ray Inman is a super spook who knew darn well that alien craft had been recovered over the years. In fact, UFO researcher Bob Exler himself, a former NASA mission specialist, Exler was an expert in robotics. Exler called up Admiral Inman on the phone. They had a brief meeting when Exler had accosted Inman outside of a National Security Agency building that was being dedicated by Inman. It was a brand new building somewhere in Maryland, if memory serves. Exler introduced himself. He said he wanted to find out more about Majestic 12 and gave Inman a card. Inman had kind of a curious grin on his face, said, okay, we'll talk later. Exler calls up Inman, and during the course of the conversation, which was recorded by Bob Exler, Exler asked Inman, these recovered craft, again, I'm paraphrasing here, is there any chance that they will be available outside of military circles? Civilian investigators will be able to have access to the recovered alien technology. Inman said, 20 years ago, I would have said no. Now, since then, if attitudes have changed, maybe the government or the powers that be will be more open to that, or words to that effect. And Exler later said, and I agree with him, this was extraordinary, because if 20 years ago the answer would have been no, that means 20 years ago the government and the military and the aerospace corporations had alien technology. Remember, Exler asked him if this technology, which had been recovered, these recovered vehicles, would one day be available to civilian investigators. Inman said, 20 years ago, I would have said no, right? And then, because we entered into the age of camcorders, and then shortly after that, cameras and video cameras on cell phones, pretty soon people all over the world were getting high-quality videos of UFOs and even aliens, pictures of aliens, still photographs of aliens, even video of aliens. Jaime Maussan, the great Mexican UFO investigator, in fact, he is the guy who runs Mexico's version of 60 Minutes. That just shows you the difference between Mexico and the U.S. In the U.S., the media ridicules this subject, but in Mexico, the guy who runs the Mexican version of 60 Minutes is a top UFO investigator, and many people have sent Jaime Maussan photographs of aliens, where you would have people mugging for the camera at night somewhere in Latin America, and in the background is a little ET. So getting back to Admiral Bobby Ray Inman, the same Bobby Ray Inman, in the wake of all these great UFO videos from camcorders, ditch cams, so on and so forth, suddenly Admiral Bobby Ray Inman shows up on the Sightings TV show and says, well, since most of these UFO videos are taken near military bases, I would say that what people are really seeing are stealth aircraft, which is nonsense because stealth has nothing to do, and Inman knows this, nothing to do with the visual spectrum. Stealth has everything to do with what's known as the radar cross-section. So reducing the radar cross-section of a craft, this was originally Russian technology and Russian theorists who came up with this, so reduce the cross-section of a craft that ground-based and airborne-based radar cannot lock onto it for any length of time. It's got nothing to do with the visual spectrum. And some of these alien craft light up the whole countryside at nighttime. What's that got to do with stealth? So when Admiral Bobby Inman, a super spook, former director of NSA, DIA, Naval Intelligence, deputy director of the CIA, winds up on the board of directors of SAIC, admitted to a UFO researcher and former NASA mission specialist Bob Exler that the U.S. government has recovered alien craft, when he rocks up and says years down the track that, oh, what people are seeing are stealth aircraft on their videos, I don't believe him, okay? Admiral Bobby Ray Inman is a super spook, and he knows what side the bread is buttered on. If Admiral Bobby Ray Inman said that it was raining outside, I would go outside myself to take a look. And that's where all this stealth stuff came from. Admiral Bobby Ray Inman, super spook. So keep that in mind when you hear people blowing smoke, bleeding, and chirping about how all UFOs, all alien craft are just stealth aircraft and reports and sightings of same. That's where that came from. All this is a necessary prerequisite because as we go further down the track and in subsequent shows of the commentaries, Bartley's commentaries on the Cosmic Wars, we're going to be delving into some serious subjects. I really encourage the listeners to plug into the interview with Jorge Martin, the great Puerto Rican UFO investigator, because he's talking about all the things that are going on in Puerto Rico, the multidimensional extraterrestrial military underground activity, the undersea activity that's going on there. We have to get out of this concept of lights in the sky. We have to get out of this concept of it's just about a bunch of power mad bankers. People can accept that power mad bankers are running the show. They can accept even the fact that these power mad bankers form a homogeneous bloodline that they interbreed obsessively, and they use advanced medical techniques to enhance whatever latent attributes and characteristics within that's found within their bloodline. And people can even believe that these power mad bankers, financiers, industrialists, politicians of the latter blood type, bloodline variety, can even indulge in sordid magical rituals, blood rituals, if you will. But they can't seem to wrap their mind around the fact that these same individuals who are part of a particular bloodline that conduct these gruesome magical ceremonies are worshiping something higher and stronger and more powerful than themselves. They're not just worshiping other humans or human hybrids in actual fact. They're worshiping something else. They're deriving their power and their orders and their taskings from something else. One must remember that in ancient times, and I don't consider 5,000 years ancient, that's like surface level ancient. I'm talking about a long, long time ago. The centrality of the gods was a given, even if we just go by surface level ancient history, 2000 BC, 3000 BC, 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. The centrality of the gods was a given in the traditions of many of the people on the surface of the world. They knew that these beings who they regarded as gods and goddesses had superpowers, had craft that they can fly across the sky with, that they had technology with which they could chastise, humble, and even use to kill humans with, and can slay entire armies of people with. It was super technology that was manifested to these people by these gods, which these people, being in some cases simple-minded, superstitious types, regarded as magic. But Bill Hamilton points out that, well, that's why the title of one of his books is Alien Magic. There is a connection between what we would call magic with a K at the end and alien technology. They're two sides of the same coin. Although I would not go as far as to say as some of the more fundamentalist types would state that all aliens are just demons, because that's nonsense, because demons don't need craft to fly around, and they don't wear utility belts, they don't have handheld devices. They don't need to experiment medically on people and extract semen and ovum from human males and human females. They don't need to use technology and medical instruments to do that. I'm talking about demons. Demons may have a ghost in the effect aspect to them, manipulating with technology, electronics, so on and so forth, but they don't utilize technology. Aliens and alien life forms and non-human life forms that reside beneath the surface of the planet utilize technology. So I want you to keep all of this in mind. In the second hour, I'm going to be delving into issues about the secret space program, my labs, military abductions, reptilian abductions. We're going to start getting into the heavy stuff. So I just wanted to lay out in this first part the groundwork where we need to up our game. We need to stop thinking like surface level people. We need to start intuiting and feeling and reconnecting with source. And by doing so, that'll allow us to plug into these higher streams of consciousness. It'll allow us to stream in our higher self, our oversoul, if you will. And it'll allow us to reactivate dormant DNA strands where we can really start understanding and not only understand more about what's going on, but actually make a difference. We will see you at the top of the next hour.